This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk, show number 28. Yes, wow, who'd have thought we'd done 28 shows? We have a chock-a-block show today. This is a real sort of indie film treat today. We've got two sets of guests, which is a first on this show. We have Tom Meaton on, talking about his film The Ghoul, which is playing film festivals at the moment. And then another Tom, Kingsley, with his directing partner, Will Sharp, talking about their film. They'll be in a bit later as well. These are people that have made indie films with passion and love on no money and got them out and seen by people, which is a really difficult thing to do. So we'll be chatting to them. But first, I have James Gill with me. Hello, James.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. James, I saw a film last night. I saw I, Daniel Blake. Which, by the way, listeners, I, Daniel Blake is out at the moment. We interviewed Dave Johns, the star of the film. So check out, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, please, because that helps. Dave Johns, it was a wonderful interview, so check that out. So, James, I saw I, Daniel Blake. Have you seen it?
No. Is it good?
Great.
Is it
end
awesome?
Of conversation.
Yeah, imagine that.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, guys.
It is great. Do you know what? It's a really beautiful, very simple, small film. A lot of things occur to me with my cynical brain, but I really enjoyed it. The performances are amazing. They're so good. It's an important story in this day and age. But a couple of the things, and it's sad, it did move me. But a couple of the things that sort of occur to me is, one, you just don't see films about working class people anymore. Like, I can't remember the last time I saw a film about proper, like, real working class people with their struggles. Like, I'm sure they used to happen more. They probably were by Ken Loach and still only by Ken Loach or Mike Lee. But it was like, oh, I haven't been in this world in a film for years. I can't remember.
Which ones would you pick out of recent years?
I mean,
Dead Man's Shoes, and that's not about working class. But it's set in that. It's still set in that world, though, isn't it?
I guess so. But it's such a sort of, in a way, genre film.
Yeah, sure.
It was just strange. The other thing I thought, and I'm saying this as a fan of the film, I enjoyed the film a lot, but it has the most simple, small story that all I could think was, imagine someone trying to pitch this to a Hollywood studio. They go, right, okay, guys, we're looking for $50 million. It's a film where a guy's trying to sign on.
And that's it. Imagine that, Warner Brothers.
And what else? But that's pretty much it. He's trying to get Job Seekers allowance.
Can we get a franchise out of it? No.
But I'm being glib and sarcastic. I urge people to see it just because I think it really does shed light on an issue that people think people who are claiming benefits are a certain type, and I think it's important to see how genuinely people are living.
Now, I say this as a man who is guilty of banging the working class drum, because I am working class, as my wife likes to tell me. Not anymore, you're not. But nevertheless, I, as I tell her, yes, I am. Why are then? Now, I have a theory as to why there may be a lack of working class films, and it's unpleasant, though.
Go on.
Is the theory that filmmakers assuming that working class people will not be able to afford to go to the cinema, therefore, why on earth would they make stories aimed at the working class?
I mean, maybe.
I mean, that is heartbreaking if that is
heartbreaking.
The case.
I don't know. I think.
Did you see Kathy Burke's tweet today?
No.
Check it out. She's a very famous English actress. If this is, I mean, I have to say that this is alleged and on Twitter, but it is Kathy Burke's Twitter account. A very famous English actress pre-Twitter said that not pretty working class actors and actresses had it easier because it was easier for them to maybe perhaps relate to the public or appear popular. And Kathy Burke, because this is pre-Twitter, she wrote in a letter saying, shut up, you stupid, and then a word that we must not say. So what Kathy done was she'd taken a photo or been given a screen grab of this magazine from back in the day, and she'd tweeted it as if to say, this is what we had to do before Twitter. And her point being that it is actually really tough for working class actors.
Yeah.
Stephen Graham has said the same thing about working class actors.
A lot of people, certainly the older generation, who were afforded grants and, you know, moved to London to go to drama school and could afford the rent in London say the same. It's like, how do you afford to pursue a vocation that costs so much money and you end up in so much debt, and how do you live in near the...
It's not possible. So comedians I know who can't afford to leave the day job, they say that they miss out on audition. Comedians who are actors, I should say, rather than straight stand-ups. But they cannot afford to take days off to go to auditions. And it's the exact same thing if you're... any actor, I suppose, isn't it? You know, if you can't afford to not go to work or can't afford to not do a shift that day, you're screwed, aren't you? Whereas if you are from a, let's be honest, a well-off family, and your mum and dad are essentially bankrolling your acting dream, then you're free to go to every audition every day. I mean, that unfortunately, that is what it comes down to, isn't it?
And
it's brutal.
Anyway, let's...
No, but there's got to be... we've got to end on a positive...
We do.
There's got to be a message of hope there.
Look, I think... I've always believed that things are cyclical. Is that the right word?
Let's go with it.
Cyclula.
It should be cyclula.
Things happen in cycles, and fashion and...
Good save.
Fashion's trends and things come back, you know. Soon people will be wearing bootcut jeans again.
But how can this come back, though?
I don't know. I feel like at some point maybe people will be sick of... And I'm not disrespecting these actors,
but those guys are great. The Eatons, we love them all.
Yeah.
They have posh names and posh faces. Well done.
Yeah.
But... I do have a soft spot for the working class actors, and probably I think you and I have said in private, the fact that Jack O'Connell is probably the only one who springs to mind suggests there's... all right, there might be more, but it suggests there's not that many young up and coming working class actors and actresses.
I just don't want to be negative. I want to believe that maybe a film or something will happen that makes everyone go, oh, we're really into this now. And then,
you know what the only way would be is for the lottery to do what they've done for our athletes, to do the same for our actors.
There you go. We should champion this.
Stop it.
Didn't they used to? I thought they did, and then it got pulled a couple of years ago by the damn Tories.
Tell you what,
this is getting very political.
If we've had our athletes, and I love sport, I was a sports writer for 10 years, our athletes, you've had a great run. How's the
good
that?
Good pun.
Sorry, not intended. Our Olympians, you've had a wonderful run of form there. Maybe ease off on the golds for a while. Give some of the money for
you. You had a great swim.
Well done. You've filled that medal cabinet.
Yeah.
God bless you. You've got an OBE. How about giving the actors and actresses a whirl? Or if lottery honchos are listening, you know, is there any way of reallocating those funds?
Or we just need to have some more like Cockney Marvel heroes. Do you know what I mean?
I would take that.
Yeah. I don't know who. Like, if only they'd, instead of Cumberbatch and Doctor Strange, they had put... I can't think of a single working
Jack
class.
O'Connell would have been a good Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
But he's got to do it in his Derby accent.
All right.
That'll do.
Yeah. Okay. So let's discuss some news that you've got to share with us.
Well, happy news in that Mike Banning is back. If you don't know who Mike Banning is, you've probably...
I've said it before. I'm sure he's a character from EastEnders. I'm sure he is. Isn't there a Banning, a Mike Banning? Is it not?
Is it Branning? Is it Mike Branning?
Branning. There you go.
I hope that's where they got the inspiration from. So Gerard Butler has a lot of fun as Mike Banning. And those movies are... I mean, they are very silly. And I have a lot of time for very silly action movies.
And they're doing a third...
They're doing
Fallen.
a third Fallen movie. I mean...
I didn't know the second one was successful enough for them to want that.
It made something like $200 million in the US alone.
Wow.
So it did, I think globally it may have been more successful than the first one. Bear in mind, the first one saw off the White House down.
Yeah.
You know, the big budget Channing Tatum movie. So, we were chatting briefly before the show. Gerard Butler is a man who is not without charisma and talent and likability.
Mm-hmm.
I do wonder if he thought that his career would go down this way, because there's a lot of love for, and I say this with love for Gerard Butler, there's a lot of love for the guy, but I bet when 300 came out, he wouldn't believe that his most successful recent movies would be with this Mike Banning character.
Yeah.
But that's it's a bit like Liam Neeson. When he was making Schindler's List, he never thought that, you know, 20, 30 years on, he'd be kicking people in the throat as a way of making money.
I don't think anyone...
No one could have guessed that.
I don't think he still knows that he's doing those films.
No. He still thinks the Oscar's on its way.
I was
nominated for Taken 3. Oh, Jesus Christ.
So that's coming back.
I mean, those films,
it's called Angel Has Fallen, right?
Angel Has Fallen.
So they've gone even more specific, and it's set in
Islington. Heaven. So they fall into the category. I know they're slightly... They're Republican movies, aren't they, really? Those kinds of films. In the same way that Home Alone is a very Republican movie. You know, one
How
person...
So?
Well, it's Home Alone is...
Donald Trump is in one of the Home
Well, there
Alones,
you go.
It
doesn't
there
get more Republican than that.
Yeah.
A man defending his home by any means necessary.
Okay.
I mean, when you rewatch those movies now... I mean, you've got to... I mean, yeah. All those burglars are doing it. I mean, I'm not saying that burgling is good, but the shooing they take is surely disproportionate to the crime. Let them have a couple of stockings. They don't deserve scarring for
life.
You do
also have to question how stupid they are to keep coming back for more. But, you know...
I tell you what, when I rewatch them, part of me is rooting for the burglars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, come on. Great actors.
Both great.
Yeah. So
Pesci, another one who I'm sure when he was making Raging Bull never thought I'll be playing a burglar.
By all accounts, he's a bit of an odd character, isn't he, in real life? Have you ever seen him interview?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
It's like, you know, there's...
Erratic? Unpredictable?
Yeah, I think so.
And I remember seeing his SNL performance when he referred to Sinead O'Connor ripping up the... Yes.
Yeah, let's not go there.
It hasn't aged well.
And the thing is... Turned out Sinead O'Connor was right all along.
It turned out Sinead O'Connor was right all along.
And you know what? She, you know, she's unstable, let's say. And I'm sure the public abuse from the entire world couldn't have helped. You know, you'd be a bit paranoid. You'd be a bit shaken if everyone hated you.
She was right all along. Sinead, if you're listening.
Come on the show, let's talk.
That'd be great. What a coup that'd be.
I love her. Can I just point out that we have had the strangest news in inverted commas.
We wouldn't have it any other way.
I'm loving this. This might be my favourite one.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure on the finale, isn't it?
You've got almost seven minutes, so it's not just the finale. You've got 7 minutes of gold to fill.
It's like doing a gig. I'm on stage and the promoter's flagged up. Do 7 more minutes.
Yeah. This is the best gig of your life. Don't fuck it up.
Keep it going. Then he runs a finger along his throat. So we were going to talk about Westworld. Have you caught up with it yet?
I haven't caught up with it. I think I did... I've done 3 episodes.
What do you think?
Look, I do love it. I obviously love it enough to keep watching. It's beautiful. It's got interesting themes and stuff. I just don't know what's going on. I'm like, you know, do you have to be quite this cryptic and slow with your information? I just want a bit more. I guess what I'm really saying is, for something that is as expensive as it is, as gorgeous as it is, that has the Wild West as its main playground, it could be a little bit more fun.
God, whereas I think it's absolutely glorious.
Do you?
I can't believe how good it is. I cannot wait for the new episode to start. Okay. It's like that. I'm absolutely hooked.
Has something happened in episode 4 that I've yet to...
Not really.
Okay.
I won't spoil it, but...
But mind you, right, I had the...
It backs up what you've said.
Mad Men is one of my all-time favourite shows, and I know a lot of people have a problem with the fact that it feels very slow and subtle and not always that tons of things are going on. But... I love that about it. So really, I shouldn't be too critical of that with this.
Well, if you love Mad Men, have you seen Halt and Catch Fire?
No, I don't even know what this is.
Oh, my God.
What the hell?
Strap in. Mate, David Trent, a comedian, recommended Halt and Catch... We exchange recommendations via the medium of text. He goes, Halt and Catch Fire. So I've started watching it. I'm on episode 5. Of season 1. There are 3 seasons to get through. The reason why you've not heard of it is because it's on Amazon Prime. So that's not a diss of Amazon Prime. That's
I've got Amazon Prime.
Oh, mate, then you, my friend, are in luck.
Okay.
It's being hailed as Mad Men, the new Mad Men. Mad Men set in the 80s. Mad Men meets Silicon Valley.
I've got to watch this.
So it's all about...
Tell me what it is.
It's all about IBM and computers. And it's fantastic.
I love it.
Lee Pace is in it.
Yeah,
the baddie from Guardians.
Yeah.
And he's terrific. And Scoot McNairy.
Oh, we love Scoot.
Oh, mate,
only for his name.
Scoot McNairy's got a great name, hasn't he?
A great name. I bet his real name is Paul Smith.
Paul Smith.
Not that. Have you watched The Missing on BBC One?
No. Is it good?
It's very good.
Really?
And I'm not just saying this because I know the writers. The writers had a history of writing comedies.
So what did they write?
They'd written a show, Roman's Empire. They'd written a bunch of pilots, and I think it's fair to say that they hadn't quite had a comedy land and you know, be a hit.
And this has been a hit, hasn't it?
And then they write The Missing. They switch to drama. I think one of the brothers had written a bit of drama before, and they absolutely knock it out of the park.
Oh,
the first
gosh.
Series was a massive, massive hit. It's so well written. This series feels like it could be, I've seen the first two episodes, it feels like it could be even stronger than the first. They've now got dramas coming out of all fours. What? I don't know what that means. And they also execed Fleabag, which is the obviously one of the most.
They're on fire.
So they're on fire.
Have you had them on here?
They're missing. No, I want to get them on, but they're so bloody busy.
What
else you got?
Muppet Babies. Now, if you're of a certain age,
just out of the blue,
Muppet Babies. Now, I'm a 38 year old man, and so when I was growing up in the 80s. The Muppet Babies was the fact that our producer is laughing to the extent where he's actually had to cut. Our producer, by the way, has grown a stubble, and if he doesn't look like an even sexier peak of his powers, Faith George Michael, I don't know. Oh, he does.
He just needs a cross earring, doesn't he? And I don't mean an angry earring.
An earring of someone shaking a fist.
Muppet Babies.
He's got to trust us that he's laughing. He's laughing silently, but he's having a whale of a time.
I adored Muppet Babies as a kid. So what, they're bringing it back?
They're bringing it back
as an animation.
Yeah, but like CGI, it looks gorgeous.
Does it?
It really does.
They've made it already.
Well, there's like.
How have you seen this?
There's like early stuff is out there. I don't know if full episodes have been released yet.
Okay.
But as a.
Is it going to be a box set binge kind of show?
wait till my daughter's gone to sleep. Well, as a man with a 16 month old baby, I look forward to watching that with her.
I suppose now you're entering
and singing along with
her. Like, you're sort of filing through and trying to find the kids' shows that
I
you
can watch
get
as well.
Something out of, yeah.
Hey Dougie.
Yeah.
That is a joyous show. Alexander Armstrong does the voice.
Right.
That's a fantastic show.
Okay, well,
Hey Dougie.
Maybe we need to dedicate a 10-minute section next week to...
Some of the kids' programmes out there are fantastic. They're really good. So, Muppet Babies, who are your favourites? I love the fact that it fused...
Gonzo
was wonderful.
Always my favourite.
Fozzie was always my favourite.
Yeah, I liked Fozzie, but Gonzo... There was something about Gonzo.
But the fact that Muppet Babies fused Spielbergian references in there as well.
Yeah.
It was an...
I don't actually remember a single, line or episode or...
Well, so they were in a nursery, but then you didn't know what was... It was all about their imagination.
And what was the theme tune? Are we allowed to sing the theme tune? Yeah, we are. George Michael said we can sing the...
Your room looks kind of weird and you wish that you weren't there.
I wasn't expecting full impersonation.
Then close your eyes and make believe and you can be anywhere.
Okay, let's... I don't remember
adventure.
This.
I like romance. I love great jokes. Animal dance.
What else you got, James?
Second verse?
No, not of the singing. Please.
So when I went to... University, I played football very badly, and my party piece...
I love how you give a sort of biog of your life connecting to each piece of news there is this week.
How narcissistic can you guys discuss it?
What else is coming out this week?
Well, as a Gemini, I thought... Oh, that's awful! Oh, I apologise, dear listener, I really do. I'll beat myself up on the way home over that. So Deadpool. So we've been very positive and happy, but in slightly sadder news, Tim Miller, the director of... That's my sad voice. Tim Miller, the director of Deadpool, has departed Deadpool 2 over the old chestnut of creative differences.
Oh, that old chestnut.
Yeah. So Den of Geek, which is a... I don't work for Den of Geek, but I think I can still say that. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
They've done a story this morning, a bit of an update. And, you know, we have to be careful. And they were very careful to say it's just sources at this stage. But allegedly, you can tell my journalistic background because I never want to get sued. But allegedly, Ryan Reynolds, the writers and Fox all wanted to stick to a budget that was more in keeping with not just the first movie, but the Deadpool ethos in general. Whereas allegedly, Tim Miller wanted to go quite literally all guns blazing and have this super high budget movie that, again, allegedly it wasn't felt was not a Deadpool movie.
I actually have some information on this project, but I'm not going to mention it on the airwaves.
Ooh.
I'll tell you afterwards.
I never like wrapping up the show, but now I can't wait to hear what it is.
Well, James, thank you so much for coming in again.
Always a pleasure. Did we maintain it? Did it end our best ever show?
I don't...
Oh, no.
I'm not sure. I didn't enjoy the second half quite as much as the first half. I'm sorry. I'm just being honest.
Oh, that burns.
No, it was every minute was to savour. So I'm sure we'll see you next week.
Oh, can I do a plug?
Of course you can, yeah.
Always Be Comedy is a comedy night that I run every Thursday. alwaysbecomedy.com.
Short and simple, I like it. And I can vouch that it's one of the best comedy nights in the country.
The best.
James, thanks very much.
Thank you, my friend.
I'm going to play us a little song, and then we're going to be chatting to the lovely Tom Meaton about his film The Ghoul. Here's a song from that was used in Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous by Cat Stevens, who's one of my all-time faves. This is The Wind.
Listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once. Never, never. I listen to my words, but they fall far below. I let my music take me where my heart wants to go. I swam upon the devil's lake. Never, 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 I'll never make the same mistake. No, never, never, never.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
So joining me now are the writing directing duo Tom Kingsley and Will Sharp, who are here to talk about their new film, The Darkest Universe. This is the follow-up to their debut feature. It was your debut, wasn't it? Well, yeah, I'm just suddenly had a moment of doubt there. Your debut feature, Black Pond. We've had Will on as a guest before, talking about his Channel 4 show Flowers, which I understand has been recommissioned.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So I guess my first question is to you, Tom. How annoying is it when your creative partner goes off and makes his own show?
I mean,
be honest.
Well, I mean, in some ways, you can't go over the fact that it is a little annoying. But
what? You're not available for 4 months.
No, but on the whole, it's amazing. And, I mean, it's a great show. I'm very pleased for Will. I should also pick you up as well. We're a directing duo, but Will writes the scripts as well. So it made sense that he would write his own thing.
There you go. Thank you for correcting me.
And I will continue to fact check.
I mean, the US election and everything has brought a whole new fact checking phenomenon to every element of the media.
It's true.
Even podcasts, which you still, Tom, haven't got your head around, is a audio only. Well, I say
well,
that,
but say that.
There are cameras here for our GIFs or GIFs, as our producer told us before the show. I mean, joking aside, you work together and apart. What is the difference? Like, so you direct some, and congratulations, by the way, not only for getting recommissioned, Will, for Flowers, but also for getting a show that is surprised me it got commissioned in the first place, right, just in terms of how kind of offbeat it is, and we live in a quite risk averse time.
Sure.
But it must have done pretty well for it to get another series.
I think it's like I've got to sort of thank the commissioners, really.
Yeah.
Phil Clark and Neris Evans at Channel 4, A, for commissioning it in the first place, and B, for, you know, fighting to get it recommissioned.
I guess it's easy for someone to sort of write a weird project because it can always just be rejected. But it's sort of more courageous to actually get it made. Yeah. In a way, I guess.
Well, it's brilliant. I can't wait to see the... I love the first series, so I can't wait to see the second one. So you direct by yourself, and then so how do you mentally prepare for when you're then directing with Tom? Who, by the way, Tom, you also direct on your own as well. Like, what's... Like, what do you get out of sharing the glory? What's the...
Well, it's partly to do with the actual production process, because on the two films that we've done together, they're below low budget. They're, I mean, so...
Micro
budget. They're less than micro budget, turns
out. Pay... Less than. No one gets... Everyone pays to be in it. Is it almost that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a pyramid scheme. And we've done very well out of that. Yeah. The money's in films. There's no money in films.
Is it Lawrence of Arabia where one of the ADs... They needed a massive crowd scene and they didn't have any money left, so he put a sign up saying you can pay to be an extra in this movie. And then they got loads of people because suddenly they're like, we could be in a movie?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And you can see it on screen.
Well, that's kind of Kickstarter in a way, maybe.
They were doing it. They were so ahead of the time, weren't they?
It might not be the right film, but I've heard it as an
apocryphal. But we'll fact check it.
Oh, yeah, please fact check it.
Basically, having the two of us together on a super low budget film is really helpful. There's basically, I just don't think we could do this level of filmmaking alone because we have a crew of two, and between the two of us, we're just doing all the jobs. Not all the jobs. We've got an amazing DOP. We've got a great sound team and stuff. But
we do a lot of cooking, picking people up from stations.
Amazing.
Making spreadsheets.
I suppose you could save a bit of time as well with giving after a take and there's, say, four casts. You go, right, give notes to those two, I'll give notes to those two, go. And then you've cut half, 50% of the time of note giving.
Yeah.
Well, you say that, although actually, I guess, we do want to, try and make sure that each of us is totally happy. So in some ways, for time, I think it actually might double the amount of time. But the one thing we do have is time on these films, this film, The Darkest Universe, took us about 3 years to make, and we could work on and off. We could kind of stop the project for a while, go away and think about it. So
go and make some money somewhere else.
Yeah. That's.
But what do you have to change mentally to be collaborative rather than, especially if you've got experience going, I'm the leader of this project. Is there ever any conflict?
Especially in the edit, because the possibilities are infinite. So that's where we tend to have our kind of longest theoretical discussions, philosophical conversations about what the film should be. And normally the conversation ceases to be productive where we sort of start to stray into grounds of what is film? Things like that. Then we're actually maybe we're not talking about the edit anymore. But I think it started because we made a short film together and we met at university and collaborated there. And Tom was working as a runner at a company called Blink and I was working as an actor in Casualty. And so we were both sort of
employed and
working in the industry, but sort of wanted to make something that was our own that we could, and we were the two sort of our various creative friends seemed to be the ones who were mad enough, for example, to go to Japan for a week and to visit my family and also make a short film at the same time, and that's spirit sort of carried on into Black Pond. And I think what Tom's saying is right, that as well as just the practical reasons why it helps to have two of you, also just kind of psychologically, because you feel absolutely insane when you're making a film for as little money as we have, and you're putting so much time and energy into it to the detriment of many other aspects of your life. You sort of think, is this just stupid? And if there are two of you, then you can sort of take turns to be the person who has
the strength
to carry on.
Yeah, so I imagine you have moments where you just suddenly lose a bit of faith in, not necessarily the material, but can we actually achieve this? And then having someone else is just helpful in that respect. Tell us what the film is about, if you can.
Yeah, sure. It's about a guy played by called Zach. He's quite a stressed, highly strung banker, and he's looking for his younger sister Alice, who's gone missing on a canal boat, and the police have found no evidence for where she might be, and he starts this quite inept video blog to try and find her.
presumably she's gone missing on a where the canal boat's gone missing. She's not missing because you'd find her quite quickly if she was on a
she's
canal
like
boat.
Somewhere. Normal size, the boat's normal size. Yeah. But that would be quite fun, the haunted house sort of version.
Yeah, that would be. And how do you come up with these kinds of ideas? Because this isn't a criticism, this is a good thing. They're not, you know, like always mainstreamy kind of in tone, I guess.
Sure.
Do you think, I just want to make something that's, you know, really... Do you think too much, like, maybe about what stories you want to tell, or do you just write what you feel in the moment, or...?
Well, originally, the Darkest Universe is based on a script that Tierney Ghosh brought to us. And so she plays Alice, my sister, the girl who goes missing. And we developed it with her, and over time, it started to evolve. And even we shot it in kind of... I guess mainly three blocks, I'd say, over the course of the 3 years. And each time we'd look back at what we had. And again, I guess partly because of the resources and partly because of mistakes we were making, some of the scenes we'd be really happy with and other scenes were just not quite playing how we wanted them to. And so the story sort of genuinely sort of evolved over time, and the tone did as well. So one of the things that we got from the initial batch of rushes was that the footage of the canals was really kind of atmospheric and felt quite dark and mysterious, which isn't really what we thought the film was going to be. We thought it was going to be a bit lighter than that. But it was we were so excited by that, kind of mutually, that we sort of started to build the story in a slightly darker direction.
So how close to filming or during filming? And
that would have been after the first block of filming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite a you've got to have quite a flexibility to sort of go to be able to go, do you know what, actually we're already in the filming process, but let's maybe change, you know, go in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, well, that's sort of a technique that we've tried to pursue, because filmmaking is like the most expensive form of art, really. So you can be quite constrained, because normally when you make a film, you write the script, lock the script, you shoot that, and you're like, there we go, and you put it out. But like in something like theatre, like you preview it to an audience, you'll kind of rewrite it, you'll workshop it. It's constantly evolving up until like, you know, the final show. And we kind of like, when you don't have much money, then you're not paying out very much money, so you do kind of have that flexibility. So we
and
thought,
you've not got people looking over your shoulder going, how are you spending our money?
Yeah. It was,
but that's a good point about theatre, I guess. I've not thought about that, is you are allowed to change it.
Yeah.
You know, you're not like, well, that's it, and now we have to do it absolutely beat for beat, you know, second by second, the same delivery. You know, in fact, it's encouraged, isn't it? So
I
why... maybe we should like have films where you re-edit them every year and re-release them again. And
that would be really
Will's
interesting.
Dying in the corner there.
Sorry.
that would be really interesting, actually.
It's the sort of thing maybe Soderbergh might do in between his bigger projects.
He's so fast at editing. amazing. We did find though, actually, like just in talking about editing, like we spent a long time shooting and editing and shooting again and then editing again. And one of our best bits of editing was when we just thought we'd finished the film and like left it alone for 3 months and was just like just tried to do other things, and then like we both like watched it separately and we both just had like quite clear ideas, like, oh no, obviously we need to shuffle these scenes around and like we can make this so much more simpler. And there was no, at that stage it was quite straightforward, like editing does become quite hard when you're in the like bogged
the
down
wood,
in it.
Yeah, the wood for the trees is a disaster. I mean, you know, you have comedic beats and elements and stuff to yours, and I think that's always one of the hardest things is, why did I find this funny 6 months ago?
Yeah, definitely.
Because
at
the moment it's not making me laugh at all.
Like
how to keep the faith of the idea you had so long ago is one of the hardest things I find.
Yeah, that is really hard.
And no audience to play it off.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's weird, like the first time we screened the film we had forgotten that a lot of the lines and beats were funny, and that's why we'd kept them.
Yeah,
and then sort of people laugh, and you're like, oh yeah,
that's funny. Yeah. Nothing worse than when people find the funniest bit that was an accident, and you're like, oh god, the thing I worked so hard on got nothing, and then this weird sort of ad lib seems to be.
That's always
flawed.
The way.
Yeah,
and you can take credit for it. So,
if Will's doing a majority of the writing, and you come on board as the co-director, How does it work when you go, not sure this bit of the script is working, or do you, are you, is it a quite open dialogue?
That part of it is pretty smooth normally. Yeah. I think we tend to have pretty similar ideas about what's exciting and how ambitious it should or shouldn't be, and what is maybe we do sometimes try or maybe arguably like over try to steer clear of stuff that we feel is familiar from somewhere, even if it's from something that we like. We might be like, oh, it's a bit,
but considering
a bit
how much has come before, that must be, you're setting yourself an incredibly high. Yeah. But
And on this one as well, I mean, I co-wrote it with Tierney, so me and Tierney would meet a few times, and we'd rewrite, and then we'd send it to Tom, and then we'd meet as a three, and it's pretty fluid kind of process. Yeah.
Do you have a game planned? Is there, like, you know, some, especially in America, I guess, because there's less of an industry here, but some indie filmmakers make their small films, maybe a couple, and then they slowly build up to making big studio films or something. I mean, there's the instance of, you know, Colin Trevorrow, who did Safety Not Guaranteed. He did one small, like, really small film, and then his next one was Jurassic World, the biggest film of the last 20 years. Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's that was kind of mind-blowing that the studio saw something in him that they were willing to give him that sort of budget. But if they, someone came to you with Jurassic World 3 or something, would you...
They literally wouldn't come to us with Jurassic World.
I know a few people. I know some people who I could talk to.
I think, well, if it felt like there was a chance that we could make a good version of Jurassic Park 3, I would definitely love to do that. But I think you're not really in a position to do that. I mean, I don't know. I thought, I mean...
But is there a game plan? Like, do you see a place that you want your films to go to, or is it just whatever story you've got to tell at the time?
I think so. We'd like to, you know, make stuff with more support and more money. But I think the most important thing is just making it with a team of people who you trust and get on with, whatever level that is. So if there was an amazing team of people in Jurassic Park 3, amazing. If there was a great supportive group of producers and writers and stuff on, like, No Money, the movie. I don't know what that would be like.
That's our game plan.
Yeah.
I would actually, right, it's a sort of a joke, but I would really, I'd love to see your version of Jurassic World. Jurassic Universe or Jurassic...
Jurassic Park Street. Is actually weirdly referenced as Alice's favourite film, in the film.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. I was saying it for a reason.
And there was a shot we tried to get in of, you know, canal, the gates to a canal lock when you're on a canal boat at the bottom of them. We got, like, the Jurassic Park shot of the massive gates opening.
See?
Didn't really fit in. So, you know, we've got the shots on the footage.
Definitely have.
Spielberg.
Okay, so when Will was here before, we get our guest to pick a guilty pleasure. You picked The Land Before Time. You said to me just before we recorded that I gave you grief about that. Like,
You seemed annoyed that I picked. You were like, "That's not a good, that's cheating."
I'm sure I'm not annoyed. Well, look, Tom. I hate to say this, Will, but Tom has picked I think something that fits so perfectly into what is a guilty pleasure, and also music to my ears, because we always on this show talk about the underrated Kevin Costner. Why don't you tell everyone what you've picked, Tom?
Well, I've picked Waterworld as my guilty pleasure film. There were the other contenders, but it's you know what? I genuinely enjoy watching the film, and I also appreciate this. It's not good in some ways.
There's a lot wrong with it. Everyone seemingly being able to smoke cigarettes in the middle of the ocean is something I've always found confusing.
Yeah, but it's an artistic choice.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know.
I think it was at the tail end of a period when smoking in movies was cool. And they were really just going, we may never get an opportunity again. Let's do it. What do you like about, like, what is the enjoyment you get from it?
I'd say actually my favourite bits are, like, the quiet bits. I'd say, like, for a massive blockbuster, which is kind of like Mad Max on the ocean, and it's quite silly. There's quite a lot of time just, like, being on the sea in this world that literally, like, the entire world has flooded. And that is such a crazy image to get your head around.
Yeah.
And, you know, they kind of swim down to the bottom of the ocean. You see these cities, which are, like, you know, like, completely swamped with water. And that it opens with an image of Kevin Costner like drinking his own piss. Like it,
that's what
it,
I remember.
It is quite. I mean, that is the best bit. Isn't it? Yeah.
No, my favourite bit is when he's in the cage and it's going under that sort of gloopy liquid, and he's about to drown, and she runs over and says, "Will you help me?" And he's just got his mouth above like liquid level, and he sort of says in a really dry way, "Okay." that's the bit I always remember. But it's a film that I think marks its era in that I don't think anyone would ever make a film on water with that level of actual practical sets.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And, you know, like one of the things people talk about is that it, you know, lost also money. The sets sunk, I think, several times. Disaster. But it's incredible that they built that. Like, I do think of it kind of like a weird art film in that, like, they really bothered to make these incredible costumes and boat. Like, they designed new boats and stuff. And that doesn't happen at all now. It would just be done in CGI. And
it was 170 million the budget at the time, and that's 22 years ago.
Mm. Okay.
So if I don't know what that is in, do we have an inflation calculator? I don't know. But that's amazing, isn't it? Like, where does well, we know where that money went on. It went on the set sinking. I think it's what is just so, to give people a bit of context, because I think it's unfair sometimes to say give us a guilty pleasure and then the listeners go, "Oh, he's got terrible taste in films." What are some of your films that are like your kind of ultimate favourite? So that's such a hard question, but do you have like a top three or something?
Definitely. I mean, well, we were talking at Lawrence of Arabia earlier. That's that's just
not as good as Water's World, but Water's World
much more dry. You know, love that. I mean, really love Coen Brothers films. Been thinking a lot about horror films recently. The like The Innocents
with
Deborah Kerr. That's like from the 60s. Okay. It's a really wonderful Henry James adaptation. That's really
the Coen brothers, and you know, there is a obviously a bit of a connection in terms of a duo directors.
We're brothers,
and your brothers clearly. But I was looking at their entire sort of canon of work, and I'm like, it is. I mean, yeah, there's one or two stinkers in there, but what an amazing run of. I mean, it's just phenomenal, isn't it? They're one of the few directors where I would happily watch every film they've made again. Even the ones I didn't like.
Yeah.
Which was mostly burn after reading, I think.
Really? I think I can see why, but I do think it's... I'd watch it again.
Would you? Yeah, I would watch it again.
Yeah, well,
but I didn't like it at the time, but...
I like the
bit
where Brad Pitt is acting suspiciously in the car. He's, like, pulling a suspicious face.
Yeah.
I remember liking them.
The film I like of theirs that's got a bit of a kick in was Intolerable Cruelty.
I haven't seen that one.
I enjoyed it. It's sort of screwball comedy kind of.
I think that's my burn after reading. I need to see it again to appreciate it because I didn't ask.
Maybe we should get together and watch each other's least favourite Coen Brothers film together.
Okay, cool.
It's a date. Okay, brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much. When can people see your film and where?
It comes out on the 4th of November.
Okay.
So they can...
next week.
TheDarkestUniverse.com. There's a list of all the screenings. There's a few regional screenings, the Cube in Bristol, Sheffield, Manchester a bit later on, and also there's a...
Glasgow,
indeed.
Great.
There's a fair few screenings in London as well.
And who else? Name some of the cast as well in the...
So Tierney Gosh, who I co-wrote it with, Joe Thomas from The Inbetweeners, he plays Toby, Alice's boyfriend, who also goes missing.
Okay.
Sophia DiMartino, who was Amy in Flowers, she's in it. Some cameos from the likes of Simon Bird, also from The Inbetweeners, and Johnny Sweet.
Jamie Dimitriou's
in there.
Fleabag.
Great.
You name it, we got some of them. also, should say that it's online as well from the 4th of November, so you can watch it on your favourite platforms.
Excellent. Well, good luck with it. I hope it goes brilliantly, and I can't wait to see it myself. This is a very tenuous link. We're going to play a piece of music. The link is Costner, but this is a piece of music I adore from the film The Untouchables, and it's, I think, the sort of main theme by Ennio Morricone. And it goes a little something like this.
Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Now, my next guest sitting opposite me is an old friend of mine, very old friend. He, you'll recognise him from his many, many appearances in British TV comedies, including Saxondale, The Mighty Boosh, Noel Fielding's comedy, luxury comedy, I should say, Star Stories, and of course, probably most notably, How Not to Live Your Life.
What's that show?
Exactly.
I mean, I've done a lot, I can't remember them all.
Yeah, I mean, it was something in the late noughties, I think you did. Tom, I'm... also, a writer, a comedian, part of the double act Aurum & Meaton. He is here to talk about a new film he's starring in, co-produced. It's called The Ghoul, written and directed by Gareth Tunley. It premiered at the London Film Festival a couple of weeks ago and has a screening coming up in Manchester this Sunday. Where is it, Tom?
It's at a cinema called Home in Manchester, which is supposed to be amazing, and it's at 6 p.m. on Sunday.
On the Sunday.
And it's part of a Film 4 sort of backed thing called Film Fear. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of, Film 4 itself is getting converted into sort of lots of doing horror films and things like that through Halloween, and they're also doing these screenings, which included Prevenge as well, which is Alice Lowe's.
Mm-hmm. Who was our guest last week.
Was she now?
She was now, yeah.
I'm in that as well.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. So do you... are the tickets still available for the screening on Sunday?
I'm sure there are.
How did it go on at the film festival?
It was amazing.
Was it?
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. We had this lovely weekend. We had a Friday world premiere of The Ghoul, and then we went up to Nottingham at a festival called Mayhem Festival, which is for sort of cult, again, a bit horror-y films, and then we were back and we had another screening at London Film Festival. They're all absolutely brilliant. It was very exciting.
Great.
Because we're quite a small film.
Yeah.
So it was all very exciting.
It's just nice to actually see it with audiences and
absolutely,
on
a big
screen.
Yeah, big audiences. And,
great.
And big audiences.
Can you describe the film?
No.
No. No one can. No. That's the problem.
Impossible.
I've seen the film and I know it must be quite a difficult film to talk about.
Well, I tell you, I can do my sort of... I've had a bit of practice at this over the past couple of weeks.
But well, I asked Alice to do her PR version of Prevenge and her just two mates talking, and why don't I give you that that task as well?
All right.
The PR version, go.
I'm not sure that's the PR version. Very good. Anyway, the PR version is, on the surface, the film is about a detective investigating a strange double murder. He then has to go undercover to investigate the main suspect, and he goes undercover with a therapist, a psychotherapist, and the film begins to unravel as his therapy sessions continue.
Mm-hmm. And now the just you and me chatting version.
It's madness. I mean, it's actually a lot about madness.
It reminded me of the kind of psychological thrillers that don't get made as much these days. Like Jacob's Ladder was one that I thought a lot about. Which,
it's true.
Well, I'm about to contradict myself. I've heard they're talking about remaking it, weirdly.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a bit annoying. But that kind of... the kind of film where you really... there is a chunk of it where you really are like, I don't fucking know
what
where this is
on.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
But in a good... not in a sort of like, I don't care
anymore.
Yeah,
I think it's a fine balancing act. And Gareth Tunley wrote it and directed it. I helped produce it, and I mean it. That's my PR bit. Oh, sorry, we're mates.
Yeah.
I often forget that.
Very funny. See, he's a comedian.
I still got it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a fine line, I think, with a lot of these films, of sort of giving the audience enough information so they don't get totally frustrated, but trying to keep it a bit of a mystery. And I think and hope that Gareth has got that spot on with this, because it is quite it's enthralling, it draws you in, you don't... it shifts around.
It shits around
about shitting.
That's why it's so confusing.
Exactly.
How did you gauge that, like, in terms of, because obviously you haven't got the money to do lots of test screenings and things.
Having said that, you
did lots of test screenings.
Well, we did. Yeah, did we in a way. I mean, not officially Hollywood style test screenings with
like
an audience
afterwards.
And a form and people who are getting paid off the street and things like that. But with trusted friends.
Yeah.
Because Gareth, you know, he edited it himself. Rob Hill, brilliant editor who did a lot of Ben Wheatley stuff, did a first pass on the film edit, and then Gareth basically did a lot of the hard work of it. And so he would get various friends to come and see different edits at different points, and of course we have we had Ben Wheatley as well, who was himself an exec on it, and he gave us some great notes quite early on
in
the edit.
And so you, from very early on, were always aware of like where that line is before it becomes too confusing or too...
Yeah.
Was there a line, if you pulled it back the other way, where it became too almost telling people what's going on?
Well, we did, because exposition. We were so low budget, we didn't actually have that as an as somehow an edit an edit option, because you didn't actually, you know, it wasn't as though we went, oh, we'll hold that information back because we've got that in the can. But I think there was definitely a case of...
Are you saying that you forgot to shoot exposition?
That's why it's mysterious. Yeah. The whole reel was lost.
How did this come about? And was it originally Gareth's idea?
Gareth's idea.
Did he always want you to play the lead character?
I don't know. I've never asked him that.
Didn't audition?
I didn't audition.
Okay.
Thank Christ. I mean, as an actor yourself, or ex-actor, maybe.
Well, both are questionable.
I mean, auditioning really, really sucks. Look, some people like it, weirdly, and they've got skills at it, and I certainly
have. Mental.
So anything where people ask me to do something without an audition, I don't even ask them what it is. I just say yes. Not that there's a case for this, because Gareth has a low budget. He asked me simultaneously to be in it, the lead, and to help produce it.
Okay.
As a kind of like, you can be a lead, but you've got to help me make this.
It was like the worst compliment in the world, isn't it? I really want you to be my lead, as long as you produce it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's taken us a long time, because of our budget restrictions, it's taken us a long time to do. But I helped him with things like casting, which meant casting all our friends.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you name some people?
Because Gareth and I met through the comedy world, as I met you, Dan, many years ago. So a lot of the people in it are comedians, but it's a very serious film, to say the least. It's about quite weighty things. It does have a streak of dark humour within it, but it's mostly about heavy business. But we have Alice Lowe, who we mentioned before, Dan Skinner, who's Angelos Epithemou, Rufus Jones, who's brilliant in Camping quite recently,
and Hunderby.
And Hunderby, of course.
Yeah.
Paul Kay, legend.
So almost entirely comedy actors playing straight.
That's right, which, the only person who isn't...
Do you not know straight actors?
No.
I mean, that's genuinely true.
I don't really. You just sort of, you know, when it's something like this, you want people you trust to do it. It's a low budget thing. You don't know how it's going to go. You want people you trust on side. So you cast your friends. I think that's just generally a healthy thing to do on a low budget thing. So Jeffrey McGiven, who I didn't actually know, but he is in comedy.
Yeah, he does a lot of comedy, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
But presumably he's done straight stuff as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
He's great in it as well, isn't he?
He's brilliant. Yeah, he's an amazing character in it, and sort of like a sort of almost like a modern day sorcerer.
Yeah.
But kind of has some very funny lines. But the only person who isn't a comedian is Neve Kuzak. Who is the other psychotherapist in it.
Yeah.
And we didn't know her. It's quite hard to cast.
Ironically, the funniest role in the whole...
Just naturally. Yeah. She's a natural comedian. She was in Heartbeat.
Yeah, I do. I was going to ask this about you specifically, but I guess it applies to the entire cast. You get probably your first like big lead role, and then your entire... Like, I've known you for... saddens me to say this number, but I've known you for like 18 years, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Wow. And we could have a teenage son together.
We could, yeah. I've 18. Always wanted that, but you resisted.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes.
In all that time, you have obviously been specifically a sort of comic actor and comedian.
Yeah.
And then you get your first lead role and it's not in comedy.
Yeah.
How were you nervous going into that? That's quite small serious role in something else first, to step your way into like more dramatic acting, but to just go, no, fuck it. I'm award worthy actor. I'm going straight for my lead.
Straight in. Yeah. I was very nervous. But Gareth sort of reassured me and just sort of convinced me really that I could do it. And I worked very hard with him on virtually every single scene we went through, which is quite rare, as you know, in these things. Even quite big budget things, you don't necessarily get time as much time as you want to rehearse.
Mm-hmm.
But we did, and we did get quite a lot of time, and we just went through every single scene, so I knew what I was doing.
And in your head, how do you like... Because I think when you do comedy, you're always looking for a thing, a beat, a moment. Whether you're doing it in front of an audience or you hear and feel that laughter or feedback, or you just know instinctively is funny, when you remove that... Does it just feel like you're saying words? Like, how quickly? How did you?
So obviously with comedy, and even this applies when you're filming as well, not necessarily live. There's a thrill. Yeah. There's a thrill when you're filming, I'm making the cameraman's shoulders. Yeah. You know, famously, you got to try and make the cameraman's shoulders shuffle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, jig about with laughter. So there's a thrill from that, obviously. But there's
or
a
making
different,
each other corpse. Or
yeah, corpsing, yeah. Of course. Yes, classic. And but there's a different thrill, I think. And I definitely felt it doing this serious stuff of just sort of feeling the moment and trying to make something dramatic slash believable slash, you know, enthralling, I guess. And you felt it on certain takes, I think, I hope, when people watch it.
I've always thought that, and this is my two penneth worth, that maybe the biggest difference between comedy and dramatic acting is probably comedy. This isn't a blanket rule, but just generally, comedy is a bit more about performing, and acting is a bit more about behavior, like being just
interesting.
Real.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yeah. I have to be fair. I've never really thought about.
Yeah. Didn't give a shit. Did you? As a
not
job.
Really. I'm just doing it. Something to do with it.
But then, a whole cast of other comedy actors. Was there not a temptation to make each other corpse or?
Well,
or
I suppose because of the heaviness of certain scenes
and the themes and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's plenty did happen that was silly. God boy, did we ever laugh. I once drew a cock and we made everyone laugh. Obviously there was a lot of fun to be had, and there was also brilliant sort of reactions from people. It's hard to talk about unless you've seen the film, but there's two beats in it which are to do with supporting actors. One called James A. Kenwood, who hasn't done loads of stuff but is brilliant, and Rachel Stubbings, who was also another comedian, who's great. And they're very contrasting things that they did spontaneously, because, you know, in a lot of comedies you improvise quite a lot, and they did two improvisations that were brilliant and kind of, for me as an actor, they're amazing. And he basically slapped me without me knowing, which obviously...
And as a producer, you had him fired off.
Yeah, he had his arms chopped off. And then Rachel did the opposite. She kissed me when it was totally... and likewise, I had her arms chopped off. it was both moments that were kind of improvised and sort of helped me, I guess. But also... And they stayed in the film. Those moments stayed in the film because they're the sort of...
I thought you meant the actors. They stayed in the film. I didn't...
didn't shoot them.
That's cool. So do you... So you're producing it as well? Well, what was the budget, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I probably won't say, actually, just because we are talking to people about...
Your tax returns. So, yeah, probably best you don't say.
No, I don't want to say. Hopefully, we're going to try and get some distribution.
Great.
And things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're talking to a couple of people.
So you need to pretend you spent 20 million on it.
20 million pounds. Fee was 20 million, in fact. Yeah. No, it was just, it was low budget.
But it was very low budget, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you're acting in something that you're doing a genre and style of performance that you've never done before, and you're producing a film that has very, very little money. This to me sounds very stressful. How did you stay focused? And
First of all, I wasn't the sole producer, which of course helps. Okay. I think it's
help.
A shared.
So you're not acting in a scene thinking, shit, well, we need to get.
Got to get some pizzas.
We need to get the food for the crew.
I haven't got enough pound pizzas. What about the grip?
Pizza in your eyes when.
It needs
some
meat. The grip needs meat. I haven't got enough meat. We didn't even have a grip, so there you go. I did a bit of that and helped sort of catering. But there's a brilliant producer called Jack Gutman who did a lot of the practical.
Very good name to say staccato, isn't it?
Jack Gutman. Hey, Jack Gutman. Give me Jack Gutman.
Get him on the phone.
Give me Gutman. But he did a lot of the day-to-day production, so he didn't have to worry about that. And Gareth, obviously, was helped produce it as well. So I did a lot of kind of getting together with the cast and talking to Gareth about ideas and locations and things like that. That was more my role. But in terms of doing it all, I mean, my kind of... going back to that sort of serious thing is that I remember that I had to make quite a conscious effort because I had to concentrate, obviously, to do my part, but to sort of do less with my face.
Yeah, yeah.
It goes back to what we were saying, really, about comedy. You know, you can sort of gurn, not in everything, but you can gurn and kind be an idiot, basically, and that's what was enjoyable.
Business.
Yeah, business.
Yeah.
And this, I actually, you know, I had to pare it down. I was really self-conscious of not, because my face just naturally, this is radio, but I'm pulling loads of faces.
Sort of very
right
much
now.
Like the sort of Marty Feldman of.
Yeah, exactly, pulling loads of faces. I'm all over the place. My arse can't stop moving. So I had to pare it all back down, just. I don't know. I think
was that the acting note? Pare it down, Tom.
Well, yeah, in was some it? Ways. I mean, he didn't have to act. Just when we were talking about it beforehand, it was about
can
doing
I just,
less.
Can I just say, it's a brilliant performance.
Ah, well, thank you.
And I enjoyed the film, and I hope people will go and watch when it appears. Hopefully you'll get more screenings coming up.
Hopefully.
But this Sunday at Home Cinema, 6 o'clock. And where do they, what, do they Google? Do they just Google that?
Google that. Part of the film Fear, it's called The Ghoul, and it's Manchester at 6 p.m. on Sunday.
Great.
You can probably Google it.
Now, before you go, we get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure, a film that
masturbation. Oh, no, sorry.
There's nothing guilty about that, is there? There's nothing pleasurable about that, is there? I sort of put it in two categories. It's either a film that you know is terrible but love anyway, or a film people hate or think is bad but you think is underrated or misunderstood.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I think your film's going to fall somewhere between... The two,
yeah,
in a way.
Maybe.
I picked
Highlander.
Highlander.
Not any of the remakes, obviously. I'm talking about
the original Connery Lambert.
Christopher Lambert.
Lambert. Yeah. Who Tarzan. Had a very short-lived Hollywood career after that.
Yeah, they? Because they of that.
What is it you love, forward stroke hate, about Outlander?
I think it is both of those things, in that you love and hate it. It's the acting. It's incredibly bad. I mean, there's a brilliant sort of quote from, I can't remember his name, the director, but saying that he was shocked that Christopher Lambert couldn't really speak English. He's been cast in it,
and
he couldn't really speak English.
Yeah.
And he had to go on some intensive sort of training to try and get...
language training?
Yeah, because he couldn't really speak English.
Oh, my God. Why did they do it, then?
I don't know.
Why did they cast him?
It's an amazing... Well, because one of the ideas, and one of the great ideas, because there's things like the bad acting is sort of very, you know...
It's Russell Mulcahy? Mulcahy. How do you say that? Mulcahy? He was the director. I'm sure he's a brilliant director.
He's gone on to
do
amazing things.
He did... he's a great director. He just made one mistake casting a non-English-speaking person in an English-speaking film.
And then Sean Connery's in it, who's doing a sort of... He's not doing Scottish either. Obviously, it's set in Scotland, for anyone that doesn't
know. But he decided not to do Scottish.
No, he's doing sort of like a weird kind of Spanish... That's his character.
No.
But he's sort of doing Scottish. Yeah, yeah, it's all over the place.
I saw it as a kid, and I just assumed he was Scottish.
He is Scottish, but the idea is that I think he might be supposed to be from sort of Egypt or somewhere like that. So he's doing some weird accent. Everyone's accent and acting is all over the place. But the principle...
Can I just interject?
Yes.
For a man that can't do accents, Sean Connery decided to do a lot of accents in his career, didn't he? I mean, it's bizarre. Like that one in The Untouchables, which is a brilliant performance, but the accent is... I'm not sure what it is.
No,
I adore Connery. I absolutely... adore him, but accents definitely aren't
maybe
his.
He's just one of those guys that likes to rise and take on their weaknesses
in front of everyone
in fact whilst getting paid a load of money.
What is your favourite thing about the film?
I think it's the concept, isn't it? It's a brilliant concept, because I have got a massive soft spot. I mean, it comes from, it's that comfort of childhood of sword and sorcery. Things like the Beastmaster, which was, you know the Beastmaster?
No.
Oh, the Beastmaster's got Rip Torn in it as the sort of bad guy.
No way.
It's got this guy who's a bit, it's incredible. I should talk about the Beastmaster more.
As a
child, it was absolutely incredible. I think it's probably early 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's this guy, sword and sorcery, in a sort of range of sort of Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of thing. He's totally ripped. He looks a bit like He-Man, but actually real. And he has control over the beasts. I'm saying that with a lot of... He's got control. I'll just say it again. He can control the beasts.
This sounds like dialogue from your lovemaking, by the way. I can control the beast.
I can't control it. My beast's very quick. But he's got... So he can control eagles, sort of like... He's got a black panther, and then he's also got these two ferrets. hang around in his pants.
That is an amazing. What? How come I don't know about this film? Was it?
I don't know. Was it it's very bad.
Was it? Yeah. And did it get eclipsed by other sort of fantasy type films?
I went to the cinema to see it.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah. I remember going. It was a big thing for me in my childhood. I had fantasies about controlling animals for quite some time. Who wouldn't? What child wouldn't?
Well, look. I think it was. I think the Highlander. Highlander is a current
distracted.
Highlander is a brilliant guilty pleasure choice, and I now want to go and see the Beastmaster.
You got to see the Beastmaster.
And also, just quickly, you mentioned Rip Torn. What an amazing name! Surely that's not his real name, is it?
Either creative parents
or it's short for like Ripley Torn.
Ripley Tornamentus.
From yesteryear. Tom, what a pleasure. Good luck with the film. I hope you get full distribution.
Fingers crossed.
And if not in the cinemas, we live in a world where it's slightly easier to get stuff on the video on demand, all that sort of
Absolutely,
stuff. So I hope it has a life.
Thank you.
Good luck with it. We're going to play out with a piece from the Highlander movie. This is by Queen, who... thing to do every soundtrack in the 80s. This is Princes of the Universe.
Here we are, born to be kings. We're the princes of the universe. Here we belong, fighting to survive in a war with the darkest power.
This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.